after he feels God has abandoned him, selling him a bill of goods. David King recalled that just before Easter one year, Charles Huff, a local Methodist preacher who wasn't an ordained minister, set up his own version of the Last Supper. We'd all go over to the parish hall where we'd sit around with candles, and we would have Za Rex. I remember that specifically. Even when he used to take us down to picnics down at Bradbury Mountain, it was always Z-Rex. In revival, the young boys go often to the parsonage to partake of cookies, and the preacher's name is Charles Jacobs. At a relative's attic over the barn in Durham, King discovered his great interest to be horror fiction. Rummaging through books, he found a battered, worn paperback with H.P. Lovecraft fiction. In revival, Lovecraft's fiction is central to the book's conclusion, as is Arthur Machen's classic tale, The Great God Pan, which King considers to be an influence on his work in general, and this novel in particular. So, too, is Mary Wollstonecraft Shelley's Frankenstein, or The Modern Prometheus, a novel about which he wrote about at length in Danse Macabre. For King readers who wanted a horror fix but didn't get it with Mr. Mercedes, King's latest, Revival, is his return to familiar stomping grounds, recalling Pet Sematary. The novel opens with Jamie Morton playing with toy soldiers when a shadow falls over him, cast by the new preacher in town, Charles Jacobs. It is Jacobs who, for the rest of Jamie's life, will continue to cast a long shadow over him and many others. When he's not preaching and teaching the gospel, Jacobs is tinkering with a secret electricity that he hopes will open doorways to the infinite. He is consumed by a single driving question. What lies in store for us after death? I want to know what the universe has in store for all of us once this life is over, says Jacob. It is his Moby Dick, a quest that drives him relentlessly on, driving him a little mad in the process. After suffering a personal disaster that shatters his faith in God, the preacher is forced to leave the small congregation he serves in Harlow, Maine. But Jacob's life becomes inextricably braided with Jamie's. As a result of an electrical shock treatment that Jacobs administers to Jamie to cure him of his heroin addiction, he realizes he's changed. Something happened. Something happened. That shocking encounter sets up a final encounter in revival that goes far beyond what the minister imagined. He gets his dark heart's desire, a glimpse of what is in store for all of us after we die. As with Pet Sematary, which King found too dark and put away in his fabled writer's trunk, he felt even more so with Revival. It's too scary, he told BuzzFeed. I don't even want to think about that book anymore. It's a nasty, dark piece of work. That's all I can tell you. Here's what I can tell you. The skeleton key to Revival can be found in The Great God Pan, which King says has haunted me all my life. It can also be found in the following H.P. Lovecraft quote from The Nameless City. That is not dead which can eternal lie, and with strange eons even death may die. As Lovecraft wrote in his story, The Call of Cthulhu, the most merciful thing in the world, I think, is the inability of the human mind to correlate all its contents. We live on a placid island of ignorance in the midst of black seas of the infinity, and it was not meant that we should voyage far. Charles Jacob would have been wise to heed Lovecraft's words. Novelist Danielle Trissoni in the New York Times wrote that reading Revival is experiencing a master storyteller having the time of his life. All of his favorite fictional elements are at play. Small town Maine, the supernatural, the evil genius, the obsessive addict, the power of belief to transform a life. Book editor John Freeman in the Boston Globe wrote, "There's a strong moral current crackling through King's fiction, so we know there will be a cost. Nothing good in King's world comes for free. Revival is a brave book because it dares to look closely at the way that religion is fiction, but perhaps a necessary one. It is a moving novel because it shows how religion's assurances are just that, hardly guarantees of outcome. On that score, there is only one we can count on, and it's that none of us know what's coming in the beyond. Not even this marvelous novelist." Our body knows things, and our brain knows things that don't have anything to do with conscious thought. And I think that it's possible when you die that there is a final exit program that goes into effect. And that's what people are seeing when they see their relatives or a white light or whatever it is. In that sense, there may really be a heaven if you believe there's a heaven, and a hell if you believe there is one. But there's some kind of transitional moment, that idea that your whole life flashes before your eyes. Stephen King, interview, The Guardian, April 28, 2012. 111. Stephen King's Revival Book Tour. In early 2014, on the message board of King's official website, the moderator wrote that King was taking a break and wouldn't be doing any on-road promotion for Revival. You could almost hear a collective groan of disappointment from his fans, who hoped to see him in person to promote his latest book. But as fall leaves fell and Halloween approached, King had a change of heart and revived his book tour, to his fans' delight. Clearly, King doesn't need to go out and tour to promote his books. He sells up to 1 million copies in hardback of each new novel without touring, so why even bother? Because it's a way to directly connect with his readership, his die-hard fans. It gets him out of his self-contained, cocooned existence as a writer in a room and into the larger world, from which he draws his inspiration. In the early years, King didn't set up protocols for book signings or talks, with the result that fans giddy with anticipation, standing in long lines, went home disappointed when it was impossible for him to sign books, after his writing hand cramped up. That's what happened at a mall in Maine, after 2 hours of straight signing. Aware that there was a long line of fans in line with books who'd be disappointed, he asked if he could go out the back entrance to avoid confronting them. The bookstore refused, and he had to walk out the front entrance, passing hundreds of unhappy fans who had waited hours to see him. They glared, and some made comments as he kept his head down and kept walking. Afterward, King no longer left the logistics of book signings to chance. Sensible protocols were instituted. For the Revival Whirlwind Tour in November 2014, King limited it to 6 cities, in chronological order of appearance: New York City, the 11th, Washington, D.C., the 12th, Kansas City, the 13th, Wichita, the 14th, Austin, the 15th, and finally home to South Portland, Maine, the 17th. Of the 6 events, 3 were book signings, designed to accommodate as many people as possible. But attendance was strictly limited to what could reasonably be signed in the time period allotted, to ensure that no one went away empty-handed and disappointed. There were no personal inscriptions and no time for personal chats or selfies. The remaining 3 visits were composed of readings or improvisational talks. "Okay, I'm going to talk for a while. I can't really lecture. I'm not good at that. And I can't speak with any sense from prepared notes. About the most I can do is Chautauqua, a fine old word that means you babble on for a little while about the thing that you do, and then you sit down." At his 3 talks, attendees got a hardback copy of Revival. The lucky ones got signed copies, which were randomly placed on seats or handed out when one left the auditorium. but everyone went home with an experience to remember. King, over the years, has dutifully signed copies of his books, as well as napkins and other pieces of paper thrust at him in public, to the point where there are hundreds of thousands of his signatures floating around. Until a few years ago, King even accepted books mailed to him, one per person, please, to his office, which he would sign and send back. But it's a practice he's stopped for obvious reasons. These days, King signs sheets of paper from specialty publishers for insertion in their limited editions, which cost $450 and up. He also signs at special events for charity or fundraising purposes, and occasionally at bookstores. At a talk King gave with J.K. Rowling and John Irving, I saw King leave the building as soon as possible out of a side entrance. But even then, fans saw him, congregated around him and thrust program books at him for his signature. He signed a few and then begged off, leaving in a waiting limo. If his fans had their druthers, they would have stayed and gotten more signatures, and the small crowd would have grown to a large one, and pretty soon the situation would have become untenable. The whole notion of getting a signature on a book is one that befuddles writer Harlan Ellison, who can't understand why the book itself isn't enough. After all, isn't that what the reader is paying for? Why does he need the author's signature on the book at all? Well, eBay aside, the fact remains that a signature transforms a book into a personal treasure. It's a keepsake and a collectible that can be passed down to the next generation. Out of an estimated 1 million copies of Revival that shipped, it is likely that fewer than 500 or 600 were signed at the 3 signing events on his tour. It explains why signed copies have sold for up to $400 on eBay. Of King's talks, only one was recorded, at George Washington University's Lisner Auditorium in D.C., under the auspices of Politics and Prose Bookstore. The talk is widely available online. As for the book's signings, at the Books-A-Million in Portland, Maine, some fans grumbled that after standing in line in the cold, they didn't have a chance to talk with King at all. They were moved through the line quickly and felt he could have just signed the books and left them on the table for pickup. Well, to be fair to King, by moving the crowd rapidly along, it allowed over 100 more people to get a signed book who otherwise wouldn't. I think those readers had no complaints whatsoever. Stephen King on death. Death is it, the one thing we all have to face. 200 years from now, there won't be any of us walking around and taking nourishment. That's it. Sooner or later, God points at you and says, it's time to hang up your jock. The game is over. It's time to take a shower. It's the end. But the point is, this is something that every creature on the face of the earth goes through. But so far as we know, we're the only creatures that have an extended sense of futurity. We are the only ones who can look ahead and say, yes, that's right. It's going to happen. And how am I going to deal with the idea of my own conclusion? Well, if you stop and think about it, and you stop to realize how clearly we grasp the concept, the answer should be, we can't cope with it. It'll drive us crazy. For me, the fact that it doesn't is one of the really marvelous things in human existence, and probably also one of the true signs of God's grace on the face of this earth. Stephen King, public speech, in Truth or Consequences, New Mexico, on November 19, 1983. 112. Are you there, God? It's me, Stevie. My view is that organized religion is a very dangerous tool that's been misused by a lot of people. I grew up in a Methodist church, and we went to services every Sunday and to Bible school in the summer. We didn't have a choice. We just did it. So all that stuff about childhood religion and revival is basically autobiographical. But as a kid, I had doubts. When I went to Methodist Youth Fellowship, we were taught that the Catholics were all going to hell because they worship idols. So right there I'm saying to myself, Catholics are going to go to hell. But my Aunt Molly married a Catholic, and she converted, and she's got 11 kids, and they're all pretty nice, and one of them's my good friend. They're all going to go to hell? I'm thinking to myself, this is bullshit. And if that's bullshit, how much of the rest of it is bullshit? Stephen King, interview, Rolling Stone, October 31st, 2014. At an early age, King learned to think for himself. Religion, particularly, struck him as being largely a matter of faith, but misplaced. It just didn't make sense. There was heaven and there was hell, and you could go to hell just for believing in a different Christian faith. By high school, as he told Rolling Stone, that was it for me. Today he's totally agnostic on the idea of heaven, but he wants to believe in God for the same reason that we all do. We want to believe that when our mortal lives end, our immortal lives begin, because it's comforting. We want to go to heaven in whatever form it takes and reconnect with our loved ones who have preceded us into death. We want the afterlife to be better than what we have on earth. The alternative, postulated by theoretical physicist Stephen Hawking, is rational and cold comfort. As he told The Guardian, I regard the brain as a computer which will stop working when its components fail. There is no heaven or afterlife for broken-down computers. That is a fairy story for people afraid of the dark. What logically follows, says Hawking, is that we should make the best use of our limited time in this world. We should see the greatest value of our action, he says. King, whatever he says, seeks the greatest value of his actions. He writes as if demon-driven. King's ongoing exploration of Christianity began with Carrie, but clearly won't end with his most current novel, Revival. From Margaret White, who locks her daughter Carrie into her prayer closet, to a fallen minister who repudiates his faith and seeks forbidden knowledge, religion is a recurring theme that bears frequent visitation in King's fiction. There will likely be more books from King speculating on the afterlife. In the end, as he told Rolling Stone, I would like to believe that there is some sort of an afterlife, to which I say, don't we all? What we don't want to believe is what cartoonist Gayon Wilson depicted in a 1980 cartoon for the New Yorker magazine. Two monks in robes are seated and discussing life. One has a serene expression, and the other, who does not, says, nothing happens next. This is it. We each owe a death. There are no exceptions. Stephen King, The Green Mile. 113. I hear time's winged chariot drawing near. It's always later than you think. Stephen King, who is painfully aware of time's passage, feels strongly that he wants to get as much written as possible, which means he doesn't waste time. He structured his life around writing to maximize his literary output. He has no patience with writers whose books are published decades apart. What, he asks, are they doing with their time? Critics often point out how prolific King is, to which he responds, I just work steadily, that's all. That's the King writing formula. Year in and year out, he writes every day of the year except Christmas, and the words pile up. A sentence, a paragraph, a chapter, a completed book. Then, repeat. When asked by Rolling Stone if he expects to still be writing in his 80s, he replied, Yeah, what else am I going to do? I mean, shit, you've got to do something to fill up your day. And I can only play so much guitar and watch so many TV shows. Writing fulfills me. There are two things about it I like. It makes me happy, and it makes other people happy. He doesn't worry about his legacy. As he told Rolling Stone, It's out of my control. Only two things happen to writers when they die. Either their work survives or it becomes forgotten. If the unthinkable happens, King, for whatever reasons, retires, it'll be a sad day for his readers. But he has created a large body of work, and there's always pleasure in rereading old favorites. It's taken a lifetime for King to write the stories, and it'd take a good part of one's lifetime to read, reread, and appreciate them. For King, it means shutting out the outside world to go into his world of imagination to explore its many dimensions. As he's explained before, the book is always the boss. But the writer's job is to write. And there are no brand names in the little room where the typewriter or the pen and notebook sit waiting. There are no stars or brand names in that place. Only people who try to create something out of nothing. And those who succeed and those who fail on becoming a brand name. He's told Cosmopolitan that he'd like to be remembered as a good storyteller, and that he prefers to deflect attention from him and onto his work. As he said in a Playboy interview about the breathing method, different seasons, I created a mysterious private club in an old brownstone on East 35th Street in Manhattan, in which an oddly matched group of men gathers periodically to trade tales of the uncanny. And there are many rooms upstairs, and when a new guest asks the exact number, the strange old butler tells him, "I don't know, sir, but you could get lost up there." That men's club really is a metaphor for the entire storytelling process. There are as many stories in me as there are rooms in that house, and I can easily lose myself in them. And at the club, whenever a tale is about to be told, a toast is raised first, echoing the words engraved on the keystone of the massive fireplace in the library. It is the tale, not he who tells it. That's been a good guide to me in life, and I think it would make a good epitaph for my tombstone. Just that, and no name. 114. Finders Keepers, 2015. I love mysteries and suspense most of all. The most difficult by far, at least for me, to write, is the novel of mystery. Mr. Mercedes, Finders Keepers, and the forthcoming The Suicide Prince, the Hodges trilogy, were extremely difficult. I just can't fathom how people like Agatha Christie, Dorothy Sayers, Peter Robinson, and Ruth Rendell are able to do this in book after book. Stephen King. Stephen King by the Book. Interview, New York Times, June 4, 2015. When the publication of Joyland 2013 was announced by Hard Case Crime, King chimed in, "I love crime, I love mysteries, and I love ghosts." That combo made Hard Case Crime the perfect venue for this book, which is one of my favorites. I also loved the paperbacks I grew up with as a kid. Joyland, as it turned out, was a tad lighter on all three counts than some readers, including myself, had wished for. It was mostly a coming-of-age novel about a high school graduate who had loved and lost and spent a summer working at an amusement park named Joyland. But the Hodges trilogy that followed would have fit perfectly at Titan Books' imprint, Hard Case Crime. Mr. Mercedes, the first book in the trilogy, published in 2014, introduced us to an engaging trio, a retired cop named Bill Hodges, aided by Holly Gibney and Jerome Robinson. The linkage between Mr. Mercedes and Finders Keepers is Tom Saubers, who was in the wrong place at the wrong time, in line at a job fair, and as a result was crippled by a man dubbed Mr. Mercedes, who drove a stolen car into a line of job seekers. The incident recalls King's own encounter with a wayward minivan in June 1999. The novel literally begins with a bang. As other reviewers have pointed out, spoiler alert, novelist John Rothstein, lauded by Time magazine in a cover story as America's reclusive genius, is shot and killed during a robbery at his home 5 miles from the nearest town. Rothstein, modeled after J.D. Salinger, had published a series of books, The Runner Sees Action, and The Runner Slows Down, that firmly cemented his literary reputation and allowed him the luxury of writing without the need to publish to make money. Though the heist yields envelopes of cash with $400 in each, the real find are holographic manuscripts by Rothstein, including sequels to the Runner series. The thief-slash-murderer Morris Bellamy is an outraged and unbalanced reader who practically foams at the mouth when confronting Rothstein. "I'm not saying you should have stopped with The Runner," Maury said. "The Runner Sees Action was just as good, maybe even better. They were true. It was the last one. Man, what a crap carnival. Advertising? I mean, advertising?" Bellamy is pissed and blames Rothstein for Jimmy Gold having sold out, which turns out to be ironic because among those unpublished manuscripts recorded in moleskin notebooks, Rothstein continues the series and writes of Gold's redemption. In other words, had Bellamy known of their existence, he perhaps would not have been so vitriolic in his criticism about Rothstein's depiction of Gold, a moot point since Rothstein's anger flares and his verbal attacks against Bellamy push him over the edge. Bellamy simply kills his literary idol, Rothstein. That would normally be the end of any story, but in Finders Keepers, it's just its beginning. And when Bellamy is jailed, again, ironically, not for the murders of his two accomplices in the robbery, and Rothstein, but for a rape of which he has no recollection, and life goes on outside the prison, Bellamy's cache of cash and manuscripts are discovered by Peter Saubers, a young reader who realizes it's a life-changing find. But when Rothstein finally gets paroled, it could be a life-ending find. Rothstein discovers his ill-gotten gains purloined, but where and by whom? And how will he recover the goods? Conceived as a trilogy, the third and final part in the series is tentatively titled The Suicide Prince. But that won't be the last we see of the winsome team of Hodges, Gibney, and Robinson, because the trilogy has been optioned for television as a miniseries. A meditation on how fiction can exert a malign hold on an unbalanced reader, Finders Keepers is on the beam. It's a tightly focused crime novel that showcases King's considerable storytelling powers, recalling Misery, in which another reader also becomes too enamored with the storytelling at the ultimate expense of the storyteller. The writer is held hostage by Annie Wilkes, a deranged ex-nurse who forces him to bring a beloved character back to life. She considers it quid pro quo. She nurses the writer back to health, and in payment, she demands a novel written just for her, his self-proclaimed number one fan. Though The Suicide Prince will be the end of this series, I doubt that it will be the end of King's exploration of the power of fiction and the hold it has over the writer and the reader as well. 115. The Bazaar of Bad Dreams, 2015. I would suggest you start by reading these stories. They show how vital short stories can be when they are done with heart, mind, and soul by people who care about them and think they still matter. They do still matter, and here they are, liberated from the bottom shelf. Stephen King, Introduction, The Best American Short Stories, 2007, edited by Stephen King. In his introduction to Skeleton Crew, King makes his case for the appeal of the short story, a literary form that, in terms of book sales appeal, runs a distant second to novels. Readers, as publishers know, prefer long stories over short ones, which is why collections of short fiction are tough sells from writer to agent, from agent to publisher, and from publisher to bookseller. Case in point, when Stephen King pitched Different Seasons, a novella collection, to his then-editor Alan Williams at Viking Press, he got a lukewarm reception. But when King offered a novel about a haunted car, Williams perked up with unrestrained enthusiasm. "My man," he cried. Let's face it, a novel pulls the fiction reading train, and a collection of short fiction is its caboose. But a good short story, as King knows, and as he's explained in introductions to his own fiction, in interviews, and in his introduction to The Best American Short Stories, is not written for money, but for love. Literary magazines often pay in contributors' copies, not folding money, as does Playboy. In The Bazaar of Bad Dreams, almost 500 pages in length, and comparable in length to Everything's Eventual, 2002, there's something for everyone. Unlike all of King's other book collections, the 20 pieces in this one sports individual introductions, giving the reader behind-the-curtain peeks at the writing process. Consider it, if you will, as codas to King's On Writing 2000. In the introduction to The Bazaar of Bad Dreams, King extols the virtues of the short form. He explains that there's something to be said for a shorter, more intense experience. It can be invigorating, sometimes even shocking, like a waltz with a stranger you will never see again, or a kiss in the dark, or a beautiful curio for sale laid out on a cheap blanket at a street bazaar. Feel free to examine them, but please be careful. The best of them have teeth. The title and King's admonition are reflective in the overall tone of the stories herein. Here's the breakdown as to where the stories were published. 2 as e-books only, 8 from periodicals, general interest magazines and literary magazines. 1 in an anthology, 1 as an audiobook only, 2 from specialty publishers in book form, 1 as bonus story to a previously published novel, and 3 that make their first appearance herein. It's an eclectic collection that amply demonstrates King's range and, at this late date, his mastery of the short story, where his decision toward concision pays dividends. Unlike a typical King novel that weighs in with hefty wordage requiring a substantial time investment to read, these short stories comprise a Whitman sampler, a chocolate box with delectables for every taste. Not surprisingly, many of the stories are literary in nature, as implied by the publications in which they appear. The New Yorker, Harper's, Esquire, The Atlantic, and literary journals, Tin House and Granta. These are clearly the work of a mature and older writer who can see his road ahead on life's path is shorter than the one behind. For that reason, the stories tend to be steeped in realism, with a certain grim tone, and clearly aren't fairy tales. Afterlife finds a man who dies and relives his life time and again. Morality, like A Good Marriage, Full Dark, No Stars, amply shows how life's circumstances can force an unraveling of a marriage. And Summer Thunder is a story of a man and his dog, set in a post-apocalyptic world that will riven your heart. Taken collectively, this set of stories is more nightmare than dreamscape. Life itself, as King shows us in these cautionary tales, is sometimes terrifyingly enough indeed. Part 6. Movies. Screenplays. I don't write books with movies in mind, although some reviewers say that I do. If Dickens were around today, he'd probably be faced with the same charge, because some of his books have been made into movies. Stephen King, New York Times, September 27, 1981. The film versions never live up to the original version, because when you sit down to write a book, you don't need a special effects department to make people catch on fire or levitate, to make people appear and disappear or even come back from the dead. That all goes on. The special effects factory is built in. There are no wires, no cords. There's nothing like that. It just happens. So in that sense, they never live up to my expectations. And only on rare occasions do they live up to the audience's expectations, My idea of the perfect horror film would be one where you'd have to have nurses and doctors on duty with crash wagons because people would have heart attacks. People would crawl out with large wet spots on their trousers. It would be that kind of experience. Stephen King on his film adaptations. Because of the numerous adaptations, film and television that have been made from King's work, it'd require a separate, lengthy volume with hundreds of stills to do justice to all of them, the good, the bad, and the fugly. Stephen Jones's Creepshows is the best general interest book on King's visual adaptations to date, but it needs updating because it was published in 2001. A comprehensive critical assessment, though, has yet to be published. As King will tell you, his movies have been a mixed bag, but the good ones stand out, and those are the ones that bear discussion here. I've focused on 11 films that I feel are representative. I've also reprinted an illuminating interview by one director who has much to say about King's films, screenwriter and director Frank Darabont. 116. Stephen, a box office king. The real superheroes of the industry right now? These writers, ranked in order of influence, whose books are source material for more than 300 movie and TV projects, have helped rake in billions in box office and revenue, and prove every day that originality, above all else, still matters. Hollywood's 25 Most Powerful Authors, Hollywood Reporter, November 23, 2014. Stephen King, at number 2, is listed after J.K. Rowling. Stephen King was 10 years old when he went with his mother to see the Walt Disney animated movie, Bambi. He recalled it was the first time I got scared, when the woods caught on fire. The Disney pictures are scary as shit. It was the beginning of King's loss of innocence and his initiation experience, sitting in the dark, watching light passing through flickering still frames of a movie. It was the illusion of life on a large screen. For an impressionable young boy, it was dark and scary magic. King's early exposure to movies helps explain why his writing style is visual. He paints word pictures that lends themselves to visual adaptation. Authors are concerned about fidelity to their work, but Hollywood has other priorities. Hollywood treats the original source material as clay, to be twisted and shaped as necessary to enhance sales. With costs running into the millions of dollars, a studio's concern is to recoup the money as quickly as possible and make a big profit by slicing and dicing the property to mine multiple revenue streams. Foreign film release, multiple DVD/Blu-ray editions, streaming video, and repeated showings on TV. Printing up to 1 million hardbacks is serious business, but it pales in comparison to a major movie release from a big studio that costs tens of millions of dollars, which must reach many millions worldwide to justify its cost. In other words, if just everyone who bought a King book bought a movie ticket, that movie would fail at the box office. King became a household name not necessarily through his books, but through his movies. People who have never picked up a King book will likely have seen at least one of them. It also explains why King's fiction is so often adapted to the visual medium. Stephen King is a brand name, and that reduces Hollywood's risk. Name brand recognition is a deciding factor in choosing to see a King flick over one without any branding. As King told Tony Magistrale in an interview, he's a bankable writer in Hollywood, someone whose movies will almost certainly make a profit, so long as the production/creative talent costs are in line. Box office is all about filling as many seats as possible, which means keeping films under 2 hours. It explains why long books like The Stand are best suited for television, which allows for more time to let the story naturally unfold. The Stand, released in 1994, aired in 4 installments with a total running time of over 6 hours, 366 minutes. But plans are underway to reshoot it, again as a 4-parter, this time for the big screen. Hollywood loves Stephen King. The real horror story is losing money on a grand scale, which means studio heads roll and jobs are lost at the studio. That's what happened when New Line Cinema's ambitious adaptation of Philip Pullman's The Golden Compass tanked. But King's film audience is intensely loyal. They love and support the brand, and a major King movie, when you count all the income streams, almost always adds up to a profit. So King films are a safe bet, which means Stephen's the king of the box office. His films have raked in over $2 billion, according to BoxOfficeMojo.com. And that counts just 39 of King's movies, adjusted for inflation. In the Pipeline. From the website denofgeek.us, we learn that King's got a lot of films in various stages of completion in the pipeline. 22 and counting. 11-22-63, 2011. A novel about a man who goes back in time to 1963 in an attempt to stop the assassination of President John F. Kennedy, for Hulu. Ayana, from the same-named short story, Just After Sunset, 2008, for NBC TV. A novella, The Breathing Method, from the same-named short story, Different Seasons, 1982. A novel, Cell, 2006, based on a screenplay by Stephen King and Adam Alleca. Children of the Corn, Night Shift, 1978, from Warner Brothers, which makes it the 10th in the series. Creepshow 4, rumored to be a Warner Brothers release. The Dark Tower, 1982, a project still in flux. Firestarter, 1994, from Universal and Dino De Laurentiis Company. Gerald's Game, 1992, from Intrepid Pictures. Grand Central, based on The New York Times at Special Bargain Rates, Just After Sunset, 2008. It, 1986, from New Line Cinema. Joyland, 2013, Woyla Films. Lisi's Story, 2006. The Long Walk, 1979, to be directed by Frank Darabont. Mercy, based on Grandma from Skeleton Crew, 1985, based on a Stephen King screenplay. The Overlook Hotel, inspired by The Shining, 1977, a prequel from Warner Brothers and Mythology Entertainment. Pet Sematary, 1983, Paramount. Rose Matter, 1995, with a screenplay by Naomi Sheridan. The Shop, inspired by Firestarter, 1980, for television's TNT, written by Robbie Thompson and produced by James Middleton. The Stand as a four-parter, 1978 and 1990, written and directed by Josh Boone. The Talisman, 1984, with Frank Marshall attached. And The 10 O'Clock People, Nightmares and Dreamscapes, 1993, directed by Tom Holland, based on his screenplay. Dollar Babies. King's official website lists short stories available for film students who want to try their hands at a Stephen King story. Because the list constantly changes, I won't list them here, but instead refer you to the source. Stories not listed are not available for a student film. King asks for your name, email address, and the story selected via drop-down menu, plus a message with additional details. The deal, laid out in the FAQ section of his website, lists four requirements. 1. Dollar Babies can only be adapted from pre-approved short stories. Novels are not available. 2. They cannot be for profit. 3. They can only be exhibited at film festivals as student projects or for demo reels. 4. A contract must be completed before a film can be produced. It's an unprecedented deal, one that's at odds with other writers, notably Harlan Ellison, who responded to a fan online who asked for permission to adapt one of his short stories, Anywhere But Here with Anybody But You. Harlan's polite but firm reply was posted on his website on October 3, 2014. Sorry, Matt, permission denied. It ain't quite that easy. First, you have to get some money. Not a lot, but at least some. Then we schmooze a little. I vet your previous attempts at screenwriting, and If you got even minimal chops, we arrive at a term of option for the story, in exchange for a palmful of that money. We sign a contract of a page or two, which is called an option, and we go our separate ways for a period of time, as indicated, during which you do a first adaptation. Thereafter, if the work you've done has some worth, and you get money people in the movie business in love with your treatment, you renew the option, or we move on to an actual contract for pre-production. Other than that route, kiddo, the story, and all my others, is sacrosanct, and you cannot even idly scrawl a Schaffer version on chalkboard for your bling gang to savor. I cannot be bought, but I can be rented. Hope this lays everything out professionally for you. King's involvement. One of my editors, Bill Thompson, once said that Stephen King has a movie projector in his head. He could be right. Whenever I write a scene, I always know left from right what the depth of perception is. I very rarely give much description of my major characters because I am looking out from inside their eyes. I am interested in the kinetics of the world, which is why so many of my books have been adapted to the screen. Stephen King, quoted by Bob Thomas, Gainesville Sun, July 23, 1986. King's involvement with movies depends on the contract he signed for the book or short story. Since all his novels are reserved for movie/TV options, they are not available for dollar baby usage. King's principal interests are his books, but on behalf of movie projects, he has variously worn several hats, as screenwriter, cameo actor, director, once for Maximum Overdrive, assistant director, The Shining TV miniseries, and executive producer for The Stand TV miniseries. Of course, he's most often credited as a screenwriter, for which he's best suited. By far the most contentious film-related project was King's battle with New Line Cinema, whose 1992 film, The Lawnmower Man, struck me as being so tenuously connected to the original story that its major appeal as a film project lay in the box office value of King's name. In a story reprinted in the Daily Press, March 1992, King complained, "I hate it that New Line's got my name plastered all over the place. It's the biggest ripoff that you could imagine, because there's nothing of me in there. It just makes me furious. There's also nothing about computers and virtual reality in my story, which seems to be all that the movie is about." As Entertainment Weekly, April 1994, pointed out, the author charged that the virtual reality pick bore little resemblance to his tale and demanded that his name be removed from the film and its advertising. But New Line didn't comply, and the matter went to court, which was eventually decided in King's favor. When the video was released with his name clearly on the product box, it cost New Line big bucks, $10,000 in daily fines, until King's name was removed, and all the profits from the home video, which went directly to King. His lawyer, Peter Herbert, said, "Stephen is thrilled and feels he's been vindicated." On the other hand, when things go well, they go very well indeed. A sleeper that made only $18 million at the box office, Shawshank Redemption found its audience on its second run, on home video and television reruns. As Russell Adams, Wall Street Journal, May 2014, pointed out, Shawshank actors are getting hefty residuals with no end in sight. Licensing fees, home video, and electronic delivery have raked in millions for Warner Brothers long after the film's initial release in 1994. The rights were bought from King for $5,000, back when Frank Darabont was a relative unknown. Darabont even got the original check back, uncashed, framed, and inscribed with a note from King, "In case you ever need bail money. Love, Steve." King's principal involvement in two films, Maximum Overdrive as director and The Shining as assistant director, proved instrumental. King bore 100% responsibility for Maximum Overdrive, a critically panned 1986 release based on Trucks, a short story collected in Night Shift. Budgeted at $9 million, it brought in $7.4 million at the box office. Rotten Tomatoes, a film website, gave it an approval rating of only 17%, and even King was frank in admitting it was his worst film adaptation. At a July 1986 press conference in Beverly Hills to promote Maximum Overdrive, King defended it by saying, "This is a moron movie like Splash. You can check your brains at the box office and you come out 96 minutes later and pick them up again." To New Times, King explained, "Listen, this movie is all about having a good time at the movies, and that's all it's about. Believe me, it's not my dinner with Andre. And little Stevie is not rehearsing his Academy Award speech for this baby. When you write a novel, you are the cinematographer, the star, the special effects crew, everything. You are in total control. Making a film, you have 80 people standing around, waiting for the sun to come out. Now that is a primitive way to create. For the record, I don't think the picture is going to review badly." He finally concluded, "I think most of you know the movie was a critical and financial flop," he wrote in Castle Rock. "The curse of expectation wasn't the only reason, but it was certainly one of them." Since the release of Carrie in 1976 as a major motion picture, fans have chimed in on what they consider their favorite King films. I've picked what I feel is representative. Your mileage will vary. King's own list over the years has been pretty consistent. In a Rolling Stone interview, November 2014, he cited several. The best, he said, was Stand By Me. He added, "But Stand By Me, Shawshank Redemption, Green Mile are all really great ones. Misery is a great film. Dolores Claiborne is a really, really good film. Cujo is terrific." Building on King's list, I'm adding the other films that I think are well worth your attention, in chronological order of their release dates. These are the ones I've most often seen cited as favorites and bests. Also, to give a sense of scale, I've cited each film's tomato meter rating from the website Rotten Tomatoes. 117. 10 Notable Films in Chronological Order. 1. Carrie, High School Hell. Release date, November 3, 1976. Tomato meter, 92%. Audience score, 76%. Rotten Tomatoes rates it as number 45 out of the top 75 horror films of all time. Screenplay by Lawrence D. Cohen, directed by Brian De Palma. Budget, $1.8 million. U.S. box office receipts, $33.8 million. In any list of noteworthy King films, Carrie cannot be overlooked. Not because it's the first, but because of its staying power. In addition to its original 1976 appearance, it was remade for TV in 2002, and in 2013, it was remade as a major motion picture with Chloe Grace Moretz as Carrie and Julianne Moore as her mother. Also, it became a musical on Broadway, where the critics dumped buckets of pig's blood on it. The novel and the film draw their power from the depiction of high school as a caste system, the perfect setting for a movie aimed for teenagers, which is an important demographic for the film industry. Drawing on his own experiences in grade and high school, and observing high schoolers from the vantage point of a teacher, King saw it all, the good, the bad, and the ugly. As Tabitha King wrote in an introduction to the New American Library Collector's Edition, Carrie's readers also respond to the portrait of high school as a zoo, a horror show, as blackly funny, awkward, and cruel as a Punch and Judy show. King transmuted his own experiences to make Carrie come alive on the page, and we empathize and identify with her. Haven't we all felt like an outsider at one point in our lives? One of his teachers told NPR, May 10, 2003, that he was taunted by older boys on his way home from school when he was in grade school. The older boys would hide in a hollow, and they would jump out at him or scare him. So I think he was the butt of a lot of pranks. His first book, Carrie, was heavily based on Lisbon High, down to several faculty members. We had a bumbling assistant principal who's portrayed in Carrie as the guy who closed the file drawer door and slams his thumb. Keep in mind the time frame. The novel Carrie was published in hardback in 1974, and Salem's Lot was published in hardback in 1975. King wasn't a brand name horror writer at the time. He was unknown to moviegoers, and in the book industry, his reputation was growing. He was pegged as an upcoming writer to watch. A low-budget movie, $1.8 million, directed by Brian De Palma, a relative unknown at the time. Carrie was released on November 3, 1976, and the box office receipts exceeded all expectations. The movie itself is riveting, a timely tale. School bullying still makes the news on a regular basis, almost four decades later, and also a timeless tale. High school is still hell for outsiders. The movie was not only hugely profitable, but also served as a vehicle for its two principal actors, Sissy Spacek, who had previously appeared in Badlands, 1973, and was suddenly thrust into stardom, and Piper Laurie, who had not been in a major film in 15 years, since The Hustler, and who commanded critical attention in her role as a fundamentalist Christian. Both Spacek and Laurie received Oscar nominations in 1977 for their respective roles as actress and supporting actress in what was a low-budget horror film for which no one held high expectations. The movie also starred Amy Irving, William Catt, John Travolta, and Nancy Allen. Spacek, who had been a high school prom queen in real life, didn't win the Oscar for her role, and neither did Laurie, who also received a Golden Globe nomination. In my opinion, they were robbed, but their riveting performances underscored what readers already knew, that Stephen King is one hell of a storyteller, and Carrie is one hell of a movie. As King observed, speaking about the book and the subsequent film adaptation, "I made Carrie, and Carrie made me." Multiple takes. Stephen King. Brian De Palma's Carrie was terrific. He handled the material deftly and artistically, and got a fine performance out of Sissy Spacek. In many ways, the film is far more stylish than my book, which I still think is a gripping read, but is impeded by a certain heaviness, a quality that's absent from the film. Playboy, interviewed by Eric Norden, June 1983. Brian De Palma. I read the book. It was suggested to me by a writer friend of mine. A writer friend of his, Stephen King, had written it. I guess this was circa 1975. I liked it a lot and proceeded to call my agent to find out who owned it. I found out that nobody had bought it yet. A lot of studios were considering it, so I called around to some of the people I knew and said it was a terrific book and I'm very interested in doing it. Mike Childs and Alan Jones in Cine Fantastique. Sissy Spacek on the pivotal scene. It wasn't hard for me to get into this scene because I'd been to a few proms in my time. I'd even been homecoming queen my senior year at Quitman High School. The lights and music were so familiar to me, and I could easily imagine how Carrie would have been dazzled by the attention. Of course, anyone who has seen the movie knows that Carrie's moment of glory is destroyed when her enemies drop a bucket of pig's blood on her head and all hell breaks loose. Literally. They filled the bucket with Karo syrup and red food dye. Of course, we had to film that scene twice from every angle. At first, the blood felt like a warm blanket, but it quickly got sticky and disgusting. I had to wear that stuff for days. And when they lit the fires behind me to burn down the gym, I started to feel like a candy apple. Spacek with Marianne Vollers, My Extraordinary Ordinary Life. The Critics' Take. Richard Schickel, Time. An exercise in high style that even the most unredeemably rational among moviegoers should find enormously enjoyable. Tom Huddleston, timeout.com. This is a truly throat-grabbing horror movie, sporting a handful of pitch-perfect set pieces. Sissy Spacek's performance in the title role is close to flawless. She was 27 when the film was shot, but looks barely half that, and this otherworldly combination of maturity and innocence adds to the film's unsettling tone. Roger Ebert, RogerEbert.com. It's an absolutely spellbinding horror movie, with a shock at the end that's the best thing along those lines since the shark leaped aboard in Jaws. It's also, and this is what makes it so good, an observant human portrait. This girl, Carrie, isn't another stereotyped product of the horror production line. She's a shy, pretty, and complicated high school senior who's a lot like the kids we once knew. Note, in 2013, the movie was remade on a $35.3 million budget and released by Sony. It starred Chloe Grace Moretz in the title role. It did not, however, please the critics or fans, who respectively gave it ratings of 49% and 46% on the tomato meter. 2. The Shining. Red Drum, Red Drum. I admire Kubrick for the sheer variety in his films. I'm sure The Shining will be the best haunted house movie ever put on film. Steven Spielberg. Interview with Chris Hodenfeld, Rolling Stone, 1980. Release date, May 23, 1980. Tomato meter, 92%. Audience score, 93%. Screenplay by Stanley Kubrick and Diane Johnson. Directed by Kubrick. Budget, $19 million. U.S. domestic gross receipts, $44 million. Key cast, Jack Nicholson as Jack Torrance. Shelley Duvall as Wendy Torrance, Danny Lloyd as Danny Torrance, and Scatman Crothers as Dick Halloran. As King told Playboy, June 1983. I'd admired Kubrick for a long time and had great expectations for the project, but I was deeply disappointed in the end result. Parts of the film are chilling, charged with a relentlessly claustrophobic terror, but others fall flat. I think there are two basic problems with the movie. First, Kubrick is a very cold man, pragmatic and rational, and he had great difficulty conceiving, even academically, of a supernatural world. A visual skeptic such as Kubrick just couldn't grasp the sheer inhuman evil of the Overlook Hotel. So he looked instead for evil in the characters and made the film into a domestic tragedy with only vaguely supernatural overtones. That was the basic flaw. Because he couldn't believe, he couldn't make the film believable to others. The second problem was in characterization and casting. Jack Nicholson, though a fine actor, was all wrong for the part. His last big role had been in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, and between that and his manic grin, the audience automatically identified him as a loony from the first scene. If the guy is nuts to begin with, then the entire tragedy of his downfall is wasted. For that reason, the film has no center and no heart. It's a film by a man who thinks too much and feels too little, and that's why, for all its virtuoso effects, it never gets you by the throat and hangs on the way real horror should. Because King counts The Shining as one of his favorite books, it was King's misfortune, as he sees it, to have had Kubrick at the helm. Because the end result was a movie that pleased Kubrick and his fans, but not King and all of his fans, who are right in saying that it's a cold film. So too is Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey, in which dialogue is minimized and the most compelling character is Hal, a sentient computer on board a spaceship. But because of Kubrick's reputation as a great film director, his version of The Shining has gotten an extraordinary amount of coverage in the media, and from critics as well. Had it been directed by a lesser-known director or a first-time director, it's not likely the coverage would have been so extensive. King's perceived faults with Kubrick's The Shining are encapsulated in the Playboy quote above. I see no need to belabor King's point. Kubrick, on the other hand, has said very little about the film. But in an interview with Michael Simon, visual-memory.co.uk, it's clear that there's a serious disconnect between what King wrote in his novel and how Kubrick interpreted it. As Kubrick made clear in his wrong assessment of Jack and his family, Jack comes to the hotel psychologically prepared to do its murderous bidding, He doesn't have very much further to go for his anger and frustration to become completely uncontrollable. He is bitter about his failure as a writer. He is married to a woman for whom he has only contempt. He hates his son. It proves that Kubrick set out to impose his vision over King's to such an extent that the film is best described as Stanley Kubrick's The Shining, to avoid confusion with King's own remake that aired on ABC TV in 1997. It's also clear, in retrospect, that Kubrick fumed at King's never-ending barrage of complaints. It seems that Kubrick had grown tired of reading King's interviews about The Shining, in which he and his movie were treated as punching bags. Kubrick kept silent as King, over the years, repeatedly voiced his objections. All of that said, judging from its Rotten Tomatoes rating, critics and moviegoers liked Kubrick's version, placing it among the highest-rated King films to date. Even among loyal King fans, there's a begrudging admiration for Kubrick's haunted house movie, as Spielberg termed it. It may not have been faithful to the book, but it sure as hell was scary. Terrifying, even. The fact remains that, like The Exorcist, there's a deeply unsettling, indeed disquieting, quality to Kubrick's film that invokes terror. From the appropriately eerie music that opens the movie, to specific scenes that get under the skin the way a good horror